The man at his table did not look like an older, oversized version of the famously scorned Esty, whose trial in 1895 had caused such a scandal in the American papers, and was known now to be shambling through a variety of European cities, disgraced and practically in hiding.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with creative writing professor John Vanderslice. His book, The Last Days of Oscar Wilde, is a glimpse into the notorious life of the writer.
The man sitting across from him was, only 5 years earlier, one of the most lionized, recognizable men in the Western world, the new king of the London stage. Of course, the same man, as if overnight, had become toxic goods, preached about in pulpits, defamed in the press and on college campuses, on the losing end of so many strident attacks.
Writer John Vanderslice and the friends who filled the last days of Oscar Wilde's life on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Menick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with writer and professor John Vanderslice about his book, The Last Days of Oscar Wilde, a fictional account of 1898 to 1900. After the scandal, after Reading Jail, Oscar Wilde, who had become almost a ghost, or at least a fiction. Writer, teacher, John Vanderslice, welcome.
I appreciate being here talking about Oscar Wilde, his infamous and very sad life.
You say sad and infamous. Let's talk about the sadness. It's 1898, and Oscar Wilde is in precarious exile in France. He's corpulent, liquor-filled, not writing. He just seems so incredibly lonely.
Yes.
And it makes sense because he's been to jail, and a few friends stick with him. But for the most part, he's really shunned, not only in England, but in France,
even,
where he spends a lot of time.
Yeah, he was an international pariah, not just in England. It was probably worse in England, but certainly in America, books are written about him, articles written about him, and throughout Europe, wherever he went, anyone who recognized who he was, the reaction was typically to just cut him. That's the word that Wilde used. They just cut me. Even old friends would ignore him, would have nothing to do with him. And yes, as you said, he had a few very close, very loyal friends who thankfully stuck with him to the end. But for the most part, he was just getting by day in and day out because those friends weren't necessarily living in the same place he was, although they tried to come as often as they could.
And they helped support him. Bought him dinners. They took him out.
Yeah.
And tried to cheer him up.
They tried to, yes. They sent him money. He also got pretty good about begging dinners himself and encouraging people to buy him drinks and such. And he tried to be happy, but it was a very hard life, and he would not have denied that.
Right. Yeah. But you said notorious, and at the same time, yeah. Oscar Wilde, at least when he was very famous, he reveled in notoriety. He liked to be the pariah, but at the same time, one that someone was attracted to.
Exactly.
It seems an irony.
Yeah, it does. I mean, Wilde's famous for saying, the only thing worse than people talking about you is people not talking about you. What happened to him is just the sort of diabolical exaggeration of that, because people talked about him extensively, but in only really negative, devastating ways.
Be stolen. Oh no, only given. And in all of the years we've been living this life.
Tell us just a little bit about the structure of the book. This
sure.
must have been an interesting conundrum to figure out.
It was very challenging because I knew I wanted to represent scenes from his life over a period of roughly 2 years. What I was trying to do in what I chose to focus on was showing this group of close friends around Wilde and how they affected and sort of protected him and then finally buried him at the end.
Oh, heart can be stolen. Oh, no, only given. And all
Each chapter begins with a place.
Paris, La Napole, Nogent-sur-Marne.
Followed by a month.
October, January, August.
And then a year.
1898, 99, 1900.
Seems we may have had more in common back then.
You've written scenes around the few friends the ex-lovers Wilde has left, who he seems to be clinging to and pushing away at the same time. One would be Robert Ross.
Wilde never pushed away Ross because he needed Ross too badly. Wilde looked at his friend as if to check to see if a stranger had entered. But no, there he was, good old Robbie, same as ever, Natalie attired in a gray suit and waistcoat, competently and quietly handsome, his small face, his clear eyes, his sharp bones, his penetrating analytical intelligence. A man who looked exactly like what he was, not never in control of the situation. He was, according to some sources, the very first man that Wilde slept with. Ross was at least 10 years younger than Wilde, but went out of his way to seduce Wilde on purpose because he was infatuated with Wilde's reputation and his poetry and his look. But they slept together that one time, and supposedly they didn't after that. What they did was become close friends. And Ross kind of had Wilde's back. During the trial and the conviction in prison, Ross was one of those who remained faithful.
You've never offered, although I've asked, for me to have your heart and keep it for my own.
He was there as emotional supporter, a confidant and a financial advisor, and finally he became Wilde's literary executor. "Bosie's waiting for us," Wilde repeated, but Ross's only answer was a disgusted glare. It was not precisely true that Lord Alfred Douglas was waiting for them. More like the opposite, actually.
All right, so there's this scene where Robert Ross and Oscar Wilde are walking endlessly toward Bosie Douglas's house. Even though this man had betrayed him in many ways, what is the attraction?
When he got out of prison, I think he thought he was done with Douglas. And his wife and his wife's lawyer said, "You can't have anything to do with that man ever again, or you're not getting any money from us." And so for a while he did, but finally he couldn't resist it. And so he kept falling back into it over time. Finally, they both did have enough, but at that point, the die was cast. In that opening scene you're talking about, at that point, they are technically not a couple anymore, and Douglas certainly is trying to move on. But Wilde still would not deny the importance of Douglas to his life and still wanted Douglas in his life for whatever reason. He did admire Douglas. He felt he did have literary talent. That was part of Wilde's infatuation with him. Once he made that reconnection with Douglas, I don't think he ever wanted Douglas finally to be out of his life. So since they were both in Paris, for me it made sense that he would want to go see him. And Ross and Douglas were both part of this close circle of younger men around Wilde, and they became competitors for Wilde's affection. Yes, Douglas was headquartered in Paris now, living in an apartment on the Avenue Kléber. But while Wilde dropped in semi-regularly to catch up with his old flame, Wilde could not know for a fact that Douglas was there at the moment.
Would you tell us just a little bit about some of the background that led up to this moment? I found what you did very well was give a sense of what really transpired in that trial. He's accused of being a sodomite, but it's by Douglas's father. And had he maybe let it go, people would have been like, "Oh, well, that's just Oscar Wilde." But instead, he decides to sue for libel. And that's what gets him in trouble.
I mean, to be honest, it would not have been a shock to many people at the time that Oscar Wilde was a sodomite. But that was something that Wilde felt he could not let stand. That was too much of a taint on one's reputation. Plus, being as established as he was and famous as he was, he had a certain arrogance to think, well, if I can sue him for libel, I'll win, and he'll be the one that's made wrong, and my reputation will be at least officially cleared. But of course, what happened is, in order to prove he wasn't lying, Douglas's father had all these people come into court giving evidence that Wilde was in fact a homosexual, and then the government was almost forced to put Wilde on trial because it was against the law to be homosexual. And despite what the law said, that was not often done. So in a way, Wilde was made a test case of the law. He was the one who they were going to make sure that someone goes to jail for.
In the book, Bosie puts him up to it. This guy is notorious for using Oscar Wilde.
Yeah.
He's not a particularly great poet. He's okay. But Wilde is so enthralled with him. How does he convince Wilde to actually go through with it? Because against all of his friends who say, you're notorious, you're famous, it'll only add to your fame.
I should say, first of all, there was a history in Bosie Douglas's family of mental illness. And Douglas was a very, very impetuous, emotional, willful person. And at the time, he deeply detested his father. He and his father were very much at odds. They were carping back and forth, sending mean notes to each other. And essentially, Bosie was using Wilde to get back at his father. And it never occurred to him or Wilde that Wilde wouldn't win the case. Although once the court proceedings started, it became more and more clear that it was not looking good for Wilde. And even then, Douglas insisted that they keep pushing the case. So I think he was someone who just wanted, I'm talking about Douglas now, wanted what he wanted. He wanted a relationship with Wilde, and he got that. And I mean, they both were very much involved in that and invested in it. But at that time, he wanted to see his father go to jail. And Wilde could be somewhat passive, and he was willing to try to give Douglas what Douglas wanted. Because, I mean, he was genuinely in love with Douglas. Well, in love and hate at the same time. It was a very complicated relationship. And so he would not have been inclined to say no to something that Douglas wanted so badly.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to John Vanderslice talk about his book, The Last Days of Oscar Wilde. We talked about sadness and notoriety. He's also sad, I think, to some degree, yet resigned to the fact he's not writing anymore.
I think he thought he had said everything that was worth saying, and he didn't think the world wanted to hear another word from him. At least that's what he told himself. Wilde was always somebody who had this affect of being this gentleman who likes to lounge and make these clever pronouncements and enjoys talking, but doesn't actually want to be super disciplined. Well, the point of fact was he did quite a lot of writing. In 1 year, he published 4 books. That was the affect. And you got the sense that later in his life, the affect sort of became the reality. He was just exhausted. He wanted to be able to just live and not worry about anything in terms of his reputation or his reception. Ballad of Reading Jail was his last book, and it actually sold pretty well. And it made him some money. But it seemed to inspire him to then write the next thing. So
let's read a little bit from Ballad of Reading Jail.
With sudden shock, the prison clock smote on the shivering air, and from all the jail rose up a wail of impotent despair. Like the sound that frightened marshes hear from some leper in his lair, and as one sees most fearful things in the crystal of a dream, we saw the greasy, hempen rope hooked to the blackened beam, and heard the prayer the hangman's snare strangled in a scream. And all the woe that moved so, that he gave that bitter cry, and the wild regrets and the bloody sweats, none so well as I. For he who lives more lives than one, more deaths than one must die.
So tell us about the poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail.
The origin of it is based on a real case. There was a man who was in the British cavalry who had cut his wife's throat and was sent to Reading and was executed there. He was hung. That happened while I was in Reading. And when he came out of prison and wanted to write about his experience, he did not like writing about himself, except indirectly. So he decides to take up this subject of this character who's hung and suffers in prison and then suffers the consequences of his act, and makes that character stand for prisoners broadly. The sense is that, well, we're all criminals, really, and the prison system has no right to treat these particular people so harshly because all of us, as human beings, are essentially guilty. In Reading Jail by Reading Town, there is a bit of shame, and in it lies a wretched man eaten by teeth of flame. In a burning, winding sheet he lies, and his grave has got no name. And there, till Christ call forth the dead, in silence let him lie, No need to waste the foolish tear or heave the windy sigh. The man had killed the thing he loved, and so he had to die. And all men kill the thing they love. By all, let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look, some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. The very first thing he did when he got out of jail was go to France. And he settled in Normandy for a few months. And in about a month's time, he wrote the Ballad of Reading Gaol. And he revised it some after that, but it was actually a fairly quick composition. And that was the last creative work of his life.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to John Vanderslice talk about his book, The Last Days of Oscar Wilde.
Without explaining, Wilde sat forward, straightened his chest, and tilted his chin, ready to pronounce the verses that had come to him a week ago, while he lingered on the beach, waiting for the fishing boats to come in. In the days since, in stray, bored moments or in the middle of finishing a bottle of champagne or nibbling on something at a cafe, he had polished them and whittled them, replaced some of the words with others, initiated pauses where before there had been none. Although he had absolutely no ambition for them, he was perfectly happy with the verses now, even proud to let them loose in the open air. It was the first time in almost a year that he recited poetry at all.
After the Ballad of Reading Gaol, he's talking with Frank Harris about this poem he's almost writing in his head.
Right.
Was he doing that?
Well, according to Frank Harris, that conversation actually happened. Harris was this old friend of Wilde. He was a journalist. He was raised in Ireland of Welsh parents, but then moved to America as a teenager, worked a series of jobs, went to law school, became a lawyer, started working as a lawyer, but then decided he didn't like it. Moved back to Europe and had success as a journalist. He and Wilde went to the south of France on Harris's dime because Harris, according to him, was insistent that Wilde write again. He was not going to take this line that I'm all done. He was going to make Wilde write. And Wilde had claimed that he couldn't write in Paris. He was just too depressed. So Harris, a fairly pragmatic man, said, okay, if you're depressed in Paris, I'm going to take you to the South. And so Wilde got a vacation that lasted for months, which he didn't have to pay for, yet he did no writing. But at one point in their back and forth about Wilde's not writing, Wilde did claim he had come up with these verses about these fisher boys that he was observing on the beach. And Harris was excited, like, oh, really? You've actually started to do something? And according to Harris, Wilde recited these verses, but there was no actual paper copy of them, and there never was. And Wilde had said, I'm not ever going to write them down. He was not going to allow himself to be forced into writing.
So let's read a little bit from this scene between his friend Harris and Oscar Wilde, and this idea of Harris listening to words that Oscar Wilde is never going to commit to paper.
At first, the words scraped against his creaky throat like shots exiting a gun. But within seconds, his delivery had loosened, and the performance had become more sonorous. Like the casings of shells that leave that gun, parts of each word fell through the air of the sitting room. They echoed a second sound to accompany the first. This, Wilde knew, was what great poetry did.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to John Vanderslice talk about his book, The Last Days of Oscar Wilde.
Rome, St. Peter's Basilica, 1900. As soon as the others knelt, so did he. Having come this far, there was no point in resisting. Wilde lifted his gaze from the marbled floor of the Gregorian chapel and offered it instead to the old man. At 89, standing before the group of 20 or so hurriedly assembled devotees, Pope Leo VIII looked like an enchanted being out of a fairy story, a wizened, gently smiling figure, some sweethearted old-souled djinn, one who could not be other than kind to despairing humans. Wilde himself would not have found out about the eccentric presence if not for the unstopping nosiness of Reggie Turner, who, needing companionship on this trip and a respite from the social column he wrote for the Daily Telegraph, offered to pay Wilde's way.
So we have Robert Ross, we have Frank Harris, And now enter Reggie Turner.
He was sort of the last piece of the puzzle in terms of the friends who took care of Wilde. He was a journalist. He too was gay. He too was younger than Wilde. He and Wilde were not lovers the way Wilde and Ross were formerly, but he cared deeply for Wilde just as much as Ross did, and he was a great conversationalist. He wrote a society column for the Daily Telegraph. He sort of initiated that. He himself was known as a fantastic talker. Not a very good writer, they said, but a great talker.
And he goes to Rome with Reggie, who you call a big-hearted atheist.
Yes. First of all, it is true that Wilde went to Rome and he did see the Pope. He went back several times to get blessed by the Pope. And he had this rash on his cheek that he couldn't explain. And he claimed that after getting blessed by the Pope on successive days, the rash went away. More immediately worrisome was a rash that had developed on his right cheek. Bright red, an ugly, irritable stain, about 2 inches long and more than half an inch wide, as if someone had slapped him, and his face had still not recovered. When Turner, first arriving, had seen the rash, he'd been unusually alarmed.
He believes it's a brand.
Yes.
A stain.
Right. On his face.
So over the course of 3 days, he goes to see the Pope, whose healing touch, he imagines, is taking his brand away, making it disappear.
Wilde believed utterly in signs, omens, portents, and divination. He believed in natural powers broader and deeper and older than logic. And if pressed, he would admit that he thought that a man or a woman could access that power with the right words, the right efforts, the right state of mind. Wilde was smart enough to know, can you really be healed magically because someone says a few words of Latin? He knew well enough, but he liked the idea that that was possible. I kind of describe him as having a ball and participating in this ritual and believing it was working. It gave him something to cling to and feel hopeful about.
And at the time, Pope Leo VIII was an old man.
Yes, he was. He was only a few years from dying himself. He was one of the longest standing popes in history, actually, and a fascinating guy. He was all about having the Catholic Church meet the modern world. I see him, and I think Wilde, well, through me, Wilde sees him as a very moral figure. And the fact that he's so old, you know, he's got that wisdom of the elderly that turns him, as I try to describe in the book, almost into kind of like a genie-like figure, this sort of magic man, which makes it more likely that Wilde is going to believe that his touch could cure him.
You write earlier on, there's so many selves. Yeah. And this is the transcendent self.
When the words were done, Wilde continued to kneel as Leo passed along the line of them, one by one, laying a hand on each, onto his shoulder, or a neck, or a crown, or a hand. When the pontiff came to Wilde, Wilde could not keep himself from looking up into the old man's face. It was then that he was stunned to see the passivity in those dark blue eyes, the motherly gentleness. Wilde's own eyes teared. He was afraid he might weep. The Pope smiled at him and then touched the rash on his cheek, that exact spot, with his papery hand. His fingers were so light, and Wilde could barely feel them. Yet the touch felt warm all the same, heated by the holy fire. His cheek had started tingling the moment he felt the Pope's hand, and it had not stopped tingling since, even hours later. I can feel it, the blessing. It's finishing off my brand. Your brand, Turner said. The brand on my cheek, the wicked mark, my wickedness. You're not wicked, Oscar, none of us are. But it's gone, can't you tell? Turner drew a slow, sad smile. Dearie, you know your cheek is perfect. It always has been. I wanted to suggest how his health really was declining. It sort of became the focus of the second half of the book, because it's true. But it was kind of mysterious, because Wilde wasn't quite sure what he was suffering from. Wilde felt a shocking new deposit of pain bloom in his ear. Within an instant, it spread outward, backward, and downward, so that it resonated close to the center of his being, as bad as before his surgery. And the doctor that was taking care of him was not a particularly good doctor and did not really know how to treat what he had. And even for decades after Wall died, there was speculation of, well, you know, what did he die of? Then he heard a tone, not like any tone he had heard before, whether natural or man-made, humming that burned and felt hard and bronze at the same time. So I was trying to suggest how he feels these pains, these sores, these weakenings, and he doesn't know how to explain or what to do about it. So all he can do really is just drink more and hope he gets better, which he didn't. The odder thing is that this tone, this audible sound, came not from anywhere near his ear or around his ear. Instead, it seemed to come from inside his own mind and settle there with preening inertia. Wald closed his eyes. It was easier to endure the misery if he did not see the faces at the same time. Dumb, healthy, living faces. Faces not in pain. And then he felt a surge of familiar nausea, what often came over him during pains of any kind. His vision, even with his eyes already closed, went dimmer. The champagne glass fell through his fingers. He forced himself to open his eyes, and as a result was assaulted by a vision of gray-faced bodies in bulky suits standing and moving without sense. Whether toward him or away, he could not tell. And it didn't matter because none of them could help him.
After he dies, what do the friends do?
Well, Robert Ross sort of completely took over at that point. He arranged for the funeral, and he actually tried not to let it be known that the funeral of Oscar Wilde was going to happen in this place on this day, because he was worried that this sort of anti-Wilde sentiment would rise up again. And what actually happened is that there were much more people in the church than Ross expected, people he did not even know and had no idea why they were there. And that was astonishing to him and very satisfying to him. And he wrote a long letter describing the church and who was there. And I made use of that letter in my epilogue to the book in which I described the funeral. Paris, 3 December 1900. The procession was to start at 9 o'clock in front of the Hotel d'Alsace. It was only a modest gathering of persons who would assemble at that hour, dressed in uniformly grim expressions, drowned in the top hats and overcoats and veils and black dresses and wool gloves needed to withstand the new winter chill.
And what about Frank?
Well, that's an interesting case. He and Wilde were not communicating much toward the very end because they had a disagreement over this idea for a play that Wilde sold to Harris and then Harris used to write a play with, and then found out that Wilde had sold the same idea to several other people to make money, and then Harris got very angry because he had to pay off all these people who owned the idea in order to be free and clear. So that put a real dent in their friendship toward the end. But of course, Ross told Harris when Wilde died. The air contained that telltale winter heavy smell and tangible wetness. It felt like at any instant it might thunder. At the moment, however, not a one among those gathered studied the sky. With a few exceptions, each man or woman seemed contained inside the border of his or her own pain.
And Reggie Turner?
Turner was there at Wall's deathbed, and he was certainly there for the funeral. He was definitely among the mourners. They scratched their freshly washed faces. They examined newly shined shoes. They softly slapped their palms together.
Bosie?
Bosie was there. Yes, he did show up. And, you know, Bosie Douglas was such an interesting character. I have him at the very end being the most outlandish, if you will, of the mourners, just crying out in pain and desperation. For an instant, they might turn and mutter a low syllable of mourning to some other mourner standing nearby, but the other would never react. There would be no indication that the muttering had ever reached the other's ears, and neither would the mutterer speak again.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to musicians and songwriters, Amy Jo Savannah.
A heart can't be stolen.
And the amazing score provided by the equally amazing Silas Hite. Thanks to Mr. Daniel Breen, who recorded the show. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer John Vanderslice, whose book chronicles the sadness and notoriety of the last days and remaining friendships of Oscar Wilde's rarely pure and never simple life. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Oscar Wilde. There's only one thing in life worse than being talked about. And that is not being talked about.